All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast, WTF. Going strong. Still going strong. Having the big talks with the interesting people. Always new. I mean, I never know what's going to happen. Oddly, that's true. Look, you guys, Brooke Shields is here. All right? Brooke Shields. I've been talking about her lately, but I'm not alone. Who doesn't love Brooke Shields? What kind of fucking monster doesn't love Brooke Shields? I mean, I feel like she's been in my whole life, but she really hasn't. I mean, when I was younger, she was sort of defining. You know, I mean, I bought a pair of Calvin Klein jeans. I don't even know if she was necessarily advertising them to me. I mean, I remember realizing like, hey, these aren't just for girls. I'm getting some Calvins. I had Calvins. Brooke Shields on the billboard in Times Square. I remember it because when I was like 14 or 15 years old, me and my buddy Dave went to New York City with fake IDs. He had his familiaries. And if I'm remembering correctly, there was a giant Brooke Shields billboard in Times Square next to the billboard that still blew smoke rings. I'm going to bring that up to her. There was a billboard. I mean, some of you have heard about it. You've seen pictures of it. Still blew smoke rings. It was for Winston cigarettes, I bet. And there was a hole in the guy's mouth and smoke rings would come out. And next to that was a Brooke Shields Calvin Klein billboard. Swear to God. And then it was weird because me and Dave were kids, 15, stayed out at my grandmother's, Pompton Lakes, New Jersey, took the bus in to Times Square and just wandered around. Some guy tried to roll us. I remember he was like, you guys, you're looking for guitars? We're like, yeah. What do you got? We got Gibson or a Fender? Yeah, it's in the alley. I got a Gibson Fender. And I kind of remember that. And we went to Manny's Music. What was that, on 48th, 47th, 48th? I can't remember. It was a very exciting time. And we just wanted to drink beers because, you know, we had these fake IDs. And they, you know, they'd serve anybody back in the day in New York. And I remember we went to like Hamburger Harry's or something just to drink beers. It's fucking ridiculous. Good times, though. Brooke Shields, billboard, Times Square. She's here today. She's here because a pretty baby, Brooke Shields, it's a documentary, premieres today on Hulu. You know, I'd like to think I'm working, but every once in a while, I see people that accomplish big things, and I can look at my life and see that I've accomplished things, but a lot of times, maybe I don't give myself credit for the work, because I'm so engaged with it. How much prep do I really do? What am I doing? Am I a craftsman? I guess so. I guess my legacy are these conversations. You know what I did? Here's where I'm at, and I don't even know what this means. But I wanted to find out how many days I've been alive. Do you know how many days you've been alive? I know how many days I've been alive. 21,738. 21,738. I'm going to break that down at some point to, at what age did I start sort of engaging with life in a real way? And how many hours was I sleeping? So I can just figure out what I did with that time. Because sometimes, you know, I look at stuff that I have, or I look at behavior that I do, and sometimes it feels familiar. Like, you know, I'm doing this vegan thing, all right? Now, I feel like I've tried this before, and I don't know when, but I kind of know that I tried it to some degree before, because I'm eating stuff that seems familiar to me that I've eaten before. Like, but not just like, oh yeah, I enjoy this. Like, I was trying to do it at another time, and somehow or another, it crapped out for reasons that I don't quite know. But I have these cycles, these patterns, and there's so many things that I've done and let go of in 21,738 days. How many of those were smoking? How many of those were like wearing boots? How many of those were wearing those black jeans I used to have when I was younger? What happened to that belt? This isn't nostalgia. It's just a time thing. How did I utilize my 21,738 days alive on this planet? It's long. It's a lot of days. A lot of days. Do you ever think about, like, how many of those days did you masturbate? Out of 21,738, how many times did you masturbate? That I'm going to work on that number because I think once I get past starting at about 12 years old, 13 years old, it's a lot. What have I put my body through in 21,738 days? How many places have I lived? How many people did I meet? How many people did I date? How many people that have gone through my life? How many? Oh, my God. 21,738. It's crazy. It's crazy. My brain's a little worn out. That's a lot. It's a lot of days to be awake, isn't it? When was my earliest memory? When did that start? I don't know. I don't know why I got hung up on it, but I was just curious. And I think it was driven by the idea that, like, I didn't feel like I'd accomplished enough. That somehow or another, I decided in the last day or two that I'm wasting time. And then I looked at that number, 21,738. How much of that was just me sitting around thinking? I wake up. Now, granted, I'm alone. I've got cats that have needs. Occasionally, Kit's around. But, like, for the most part, I'm a solo operation. And 21,738 days. Some people make movies. They spend years doing a thing. They build things. They're like, look what I built. It's a whole building. Look, I built a house. Look, I made this piece of art that's in a park. Look what I made. I made a car from scratch. Look, it's a pizza. I made a pizza. That one's a little less impressive. But what did I make? 21,738 days. I've talked a lot. I've taken a few pictures. I've appeared in some things. But man, I gotta build a building or something, man. 21,738 days. How much of that was I just thinking about the same shit that I always think about? How many hours of the 21,738 days alive on this planet was I just thinking the same fucking things I think all the time? I gotta break out, man. I think it was just I wanted a number to sort of judge myself against in terms of, you know, time spent. Because I can burn through a day, man, with not much to show for it, except maybe a baked potato or a nice cabbage salad. Just burn through it. But then I'm kind of thinking, like, is that a problem? I mean, what am I going to do when I don't want to work anymore? Some days I feel like that's on the horizon. Is there anything wrong with utilizing your day in a way that just all you have to show for it is, I had some fun thinking about some stuff, and I made this nice salad, and I hiked up the hill. Is there anything wrong with that day? What do I owe the fucking world? 21,738 days. How much of that was spent beating the shit out of myself? How many hours? How much of that was fun? How much of that was high? It's wild, man. When you put a number on it, you put a number on it. There it is. That's how many days. And I'm not even thinking about how many days do I have left. Brooke Shields is here. The documentary Pretty Baby, Brooke Shields, is now available to stream on Hulu. And it's great. And she's great. And I couldn't have been more excited to talk to somebody. This week, I'm very excited to talk to Brooke Shields. And I was excited for Thursdays, too. But that's not what's happening now. Right now, it's Brooke Shields time. Here we go. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial
plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
But, like, I get totally invested. I can't watch shows where animals... It's very hard for me to watch...
To me, and there's a, you know, anthropomorphism.
Yes.
I do that absolutely.
Oh, all the time.
All the time.
All day long with these cats. All day long.
All day long.
I do it with cats.
My dog was a talker.
Oh, yeah.
And she would, all the time. And I've got this one video, and I don't know, it just worked out perfectly. And I said, "Do you love me?" And she went, "Uh-huh." And I was like, "Oh, my God, she speaks."
Gets it. Yeah. A miracle dog.
Oh, anyway.
I'm glad I had honest vets, because sometimes they'll just drag it on. Like, because I've been in situations with these animals where I'm giving them,
IV
fluids and do it. It's a nightmare.
Well, it's fine. I mean, I went the opposite way. Yeah. You know, I was like, oh, maybe we can, because she had a tumor on her spine.
Yeah.
And by the time we found it, it was massive and it had just stopped her back legs from working. But it was one day she was fine. The next day she was dragging her hind legs.
Oh,
and,
no.
You know, and I'm going, well, what about those little wheelies? And
those
little,
get that?
You know, and my husband was like, babe, she's waking up in her own excrement. That's not the way.
At some point you have to draw this line. It's sort of like, it's an animal and it's had a good run.
Well, I went back and, of course, obsessively started looking at all videos and, you know, of her leaping into the pool and running on the beach. And
I
thought, you know what? That's what she, how she lived. So we gave her that.
Yeah.
And now it's, you know, but boy, I mean, anyway, it was, but hey, I'm here.
You're okay. And I think it's, you know, being a steward, having stewardship of an animal into passing is better. It's better than it being hit by a car or letting it suffer.
Yeah, absolutely. And also you see their little faces and then they
relax them.
They don't look like that they're...
No, they just
themselves.
Kinda,
you know what I mean? Like they looked, they actually, when the whatever,
when,
I don't know.
Oh, the life goes out of them?
Yeah. They just, she didn't look like herself anymore. I mean, same thing happened with my mom when I saw my mom die.
Did you have your mom put down?
I put my mom down too, But I didn't bother with the first shot. I just went for the second shot. And what it does, there's like something that happens and they're not there anymore.
Yeah,
you know?
I definitely can witness that. So wait, so you were there when your mom died?
I was. I insisted on sort of staring at her because I was not present for my father's death. I wasn't.
Was that before?
Yes. It was about, God, now it's 18, 19 years ago, 3 weeks before my daughter was born.
Did he die suddenly?
No, but he had prostate cancer, which is just infuriating.
Because you can catch that one.
Yeah. But he was of the school of, well, no, I'm not going to go to the doctor because they'll
going
find
in there.
Something.
Yeah.
Well, there's no one going in there. And nope.
Yeah.
Not there. And so anyway, that by the time they found it, it was very late.
Oh, my
God. Yeah. So I thought, okay, well, I'm my mom's only daughter. So I sat there. And, you know, you think it's going to be like in the movies.
Yeah.
With the sigh. And the just, you know, the look, whatever. I mean, you know, she had had her mouth open for about a week by that point. And she, you know, she started the, and then the teeth would close. And it was just, it was like a horror movie.
The organ failure, right?
I guess.
Like her breathing was real heavy. And
But
like every breath was like that?
But she would not breathe for a while. And then she'd gasp open and then shut her teeth together really tight. It was just, it was
awful.
Horror. It was just, I mean, it was one of those things. And the night before she had had, before she died, all these nurses came in, and it was during Hurricane Sandy, and we had lost power, and I was sort of stuck uptown, and I was just, and slept in bed with her, and they gave us these little, you know, pill cups, like in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and they had given me a bottle, and it had 3/4 water in it, and they kept saying, you've got to hydrate, and I said, all right, I'll hydrate, my God, I'm not, I chug this thing down. They had smuggled in fluff vodka.
Yeah.
And given me a whole Poland Spring bottle filled with fluff vodka for some
reason.
What's
fluff vodka?
It's like the cotton candy flavor cake flavor.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, marshmallow fluff?
Yeah, like that.
Okay.
And they were like, we got your back? And I was like, yeah. They put some by my mom.
Thanks for the horrible thing.
Yes, by my mom's lips.
Yeah.
Her lips clamped down on that little fluff vodka like her life depended on it.
Oh, she loved it?
Yeah.
It all came back?
I was like, it's not going to kill her, you know? So that was her last...
Her last drink?
Her last drink. Her last meal.
Well, you know, I watch a documentary and it's like, it's difficult when I see, you know, it becomes tricky. Like, so what are we going to talk about?
I know.
It's all there. But there was stuff, though. I mean, there's like the fact that you were there for your mother's death and how she played so heavily into your life as this... you know, guiding force for better or for worse. I mean, you kind of talked about it a little bit in the film, but were you detached when she was dying?
Detached? Oh, God, I don't know. I think I was doing that self-defense thing where you, the defensive mechanism where you're playing a role.
Yeah.
All of a sudden I was like, the child by the dying mother, you know, and I because it was this, I just went in and I wanted so much to be present because I didn't want to miss anything. The thing is, she was not there for such a long time.
She had dementia.
Yeah.
My dad just started that.
Oh.
Seems exciting.
It's very exciting. Yeah. It's very fun. And it's great when they don't know your name.
I'm waiting for that.
And you get mad at them. But my mom would, you know, she would do things like heat soup up on the open flame, but in the ceramic bowl.
Oh, yeah.
And I'd be like, Ma, you know, that's not me. She's like, fuck the middleman.
Yeah.
You know,
so she actually knew what she was doing.
Yeah, she was, that was her way of going through the world, you know, so I. You know,
she'd said that before about other things?
Oh, always. Yeah. Always fuck the middleman. And, you know, all the nurses had all these stories about her.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, they were arguing whether she was more Dominican or more Cuban or more, you know, she was one of theirs. They were having these like, I call her Terrytown. I call her Mike T.
Yeah.
She said I had a beautiful smile. No one ever told me that. I mean, it was like she had this whole life with
at the hospital,
at the home.
In random fragments of niceness and whatnot.
And she registered with people. Like that's what she did, you know.
So right up till the end.
Yeah.
She was charismatic and connected.
Oh, yeah. And she was and it was Halloween during Hurricane Sandy.
Yeah.
I mean, she's like, fuck you, I'm Hurricane Terry. You know, like, I'm not going out. Yeah. You know, she was abroad.
She was a
figure, you know.
But how do you feel now? Do you miss her?
I miss parts of her. I don't miss the worry. I don't miss the alcoholism. I don't miss the burden of being everything to her.
Yeah.
You know, and she never turned into the sweet little old grandmother, you know, that was going to be able to. No, I mean, she's the woman who filled the bathtub up and my 2-year-old daughter was running around naked and she got locked out of the house. You know.
And she's a monster to the end.
And she's like, well, if you had given me a key, I would be able. I was like, well, no, that wouldn't have helped, Mom.
Oh, my God.
You would have left the key inside and you would
have. But this is before she was sick.
This is as we were realizing something was amiss.
Yeah. One thing I realized like when I saw you for the first time and I was like, oh my God, Brooke Shields. I feel like I've known you my whole life. That like in retrospect, after watching the documentary, I'm like, oh God, that's what everyone says to her.
Well, but you know what? It's like I'm like, people imprint on me, but they don't even know it. It's just I'm part of like the zeitgeist of an era of someone's life and they don't realize it, that it's... There's that,
like almost a constant in a way.
Well, I mean, God, I've 56 years.
Right. I had no idea really until I put it all into context, just how huge you were, a presence in the culture. Like you were just like everyone knew you. Brooke Shields.
And it was this huge projection at different times for different reasons.
I know, but when did you see, like, that's interesting to me because, and I'm not bragging, but I married a model. It didn't go well. But I realized when I met her, because she was going into comedy and she'd gotten out of that racket because it's a horrible life in a lot of ways, modeling. And it's dangerous to some women, just in terms of how they manage their body.
Oh, it's sick.
Yeah. And, but so I was happy she got out. But the idea of this natural gift of beauty being this kind of tabula rasa for people to just, you know, make their own in some weird way, to project almost, you know, anything, whether it's sexual or not, onto, mm-hmm. and I mean, that's the job of it. But I mean, when did you, what, because it seems like in the documentary, you've had to kind of backload a lot of information as you learned it as an older person,
yeah,
about your situation. But when did you know that, that you were just this blank page in a way, just this thing that represented beauty, but everyone was going to make you what they want to?
I mean, I think I was subtly realizing it all along the way, but just probably couldn't articulate it.
Yeah.
But the problem was I was also getting approval for it.
Right.
So that's very fueling, and it's enough. As a little girl, you're liked, right?
Yeah.
If they say, you know, if you're pretty or you do a good job, or
I guess that's right, right?
You're liked, you know, and you get invited back.
Sure.
You know, and I think that I thrived on that because I wanted to be a good girl and I wanted to please everybody. And
also, like, but your mom at that point, when you were like, I mean, you started when you were a baby, but I mean, like, even when you were 5 or 6 or whatever, was she scary? Yet?
She didn't, I think that she was just so bohemian that we were always around like a lot
of
really.
Is that code for a bad parent?
I think it's probably. I mean, she had this weird sense of like she just took me everywhere, you know? And I mean, we were going when I was like 7 or 8, we went to see Rocky Horror Picture Show at a gay bar with all, you know, guys in cages.
Sure.
And she was that mom. And she was, you know,
that's sort of a singular thing. It wasn't like you'd go to these places, there were several other moms doing that.
No. And the fact that other mothers would let her take their kids.
Oh, really?
So she was just, she was always larger than life.
Yeah.
But I don't think I realized it until sort of I was about in my, by the time I did my first intervention, which
with
was
her?
13, yeah.
13?
I was 13.
When you did that, oh yeah?
Yeah, my first.
But do you think, like, in looking back on it, that there was some sort of order to, you know, a set to...
It saved my life.
Because, like, yeah.
I mean, everybody knew where I was at all times. I was completely safe.
Yeah.
I was accounted for.
Yeah.
I was fed.
People were nice to you?
People were nice to me.
Yeah.
And I had a routine. And you got a piece of paper.
Yeah.
And you had to look at those lines. And that's what you did. And you had a piece of paper for every day.
And then someone would take you to school.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the trailer.
Exactly. And you had timed meals. And there was something so just safe about it.
It must have been really.
Whereas being a kid in New York with a mom who was a single mom who drank, you never knew what I mean. I wasn't fearful. I mean, she never hit me.
No,
there was no.
No, that's good.
No, not.
Were there men in and out of the house kind of deal?
Not really.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
You
were it.
I was it. And then she sort of found one person who kind of was more of a provider. And I knew I was like, that can't be your type. I mean, you can't go from dad to that, you know, but he was generous and took us on trips. And
well, what is that? Old man?
Presents.
Wait.
No, he was just wasn't very attractive, but he was very loving to me and it was nice and he was generous. He gave me stuff all the time. And I think my mom just sort of thought, okay, this is going to be helpful for a little while.
Well, I like it that she was so practical about everything. She'd really given up on, you know, I guess passion and joy to a degree.
I also think she was a, you can't fire me, I quit person.
Yeah,
you know, she was
fuck
not.
You person.
Yeah. And like, she wasn't going to let herself be hurt. I mean, she divorced my father without even telling him. She went to Mexico.
Well, what was the backstory on that? He didn't want the baby?
No, it wasn't even that. She didn't want to get an abortion, first of all.
Right.
Then he thought that the whole thing was going to be taken care of.
Because they weren't married.
No.
It was just a fling?
You know what? I think it was a really good weekend.
Right.
And I think she was like a heat-seeking missile.
Yeah.
And she was 9 years older than he was. And here was
a pretty guy.
Oh, he's just beautiful. I mean, he was an Adonis.
And
she just fell really, really hard. And I think she got pregnant, I think, that weekend or whatever, maybe that first encounter, I don't know. And she kind of got her hooks into him. And then when she told him that she was pregnant, then he thought, well, I can't do that.
Yeah.
I can't have a child out of wedlock. And this is going to ruin my reputation.
What was his family like?
Very blue blood, Upper East Side, WASPy,
really?
You know, Penn. His mother was a princess in Rome. His father
An Italian princess?
Yeah, Rome, like real deal princess. And he was sort of raised half that way. And then his father was the number one tennis player in the world.
Did you know that guy?
And I knew him when I was two. I think by the time I was three, he died. But he was also an actor under contract at Paramount.
This tennis-playing Italian guy?
Italian.
Oh, he was Italian.
Irish, yeah.
Huh.
Irish-English.
Huh.
You know, a gorgeous 6'7".
An Irish-English actor tennis player.
Yeah. I mean, go figure. So
what? Then you ended up with a tennis player.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering what the imprints are on that.
Well, the toast was really easy for my father at that point. He had a Davis Cup medal, and it was like, oh, everybody was just welcome, Dad.
Yeah. Wow. So, but what do you, have you tracked that lineage of royalty?
Yeah.
You have?
I did. So they do that. It's not 23andMe. It's Who Do You Think You Are, that television show started at the BBC, and then Lisa Kudrow did it here in America.
Oh, yeah, I remember.
And they charted my DNA, and they said, do you have any questions about your past? And I said, yeah, is this true about my dad's lineage? Like, come on, everybody. Yeah. I mean, everybody's royalty in Italy. Like, it's, you know, and what does that mean? And we have five stars on our crest and all this. And, you know, my mom was Newark. Right.
Yeah, right.
So
that's it. That's a category on itself. Yeah, Newark.
Newark. And you have to say it like that. And I was, you know, I've been straddling that bizarre fence probably my whole life.
But was there a moment where you're like, where are the jewels?
Oh, no. I confronted my father one day because there was this palazzo. It was beautiful. And we all owned a portion of it.
Yeah.
And he sold off my part.
Before? Oh.
And I said, Dad, I'm the first grandchild. There had to have been something in there.
Yeah.
He goes, well, no, not anymore. We need to buy this house in Long Island. And I was like, oh, okay.
No palazzo, huh?
No palazzo, no.
Do you have royal cousins and stuff?
Yeah. I mean, one of them's getting married this summer.
You're in touch?
Yes, we are in touch. But it was one of those things where I was like, okay, that's what I want to know about my dad's side. And what I want to know about my mom's side is I hate my grandmother.
Yeah.
I've always hated her. And I know that. But I would like to understand so that maybe I can take the hate out of my heart and have some sort of empathy or understanding.
This is your mom's mom?
Yeah, my mom's mom.
What would you find out?
Wretched.
What'd you find?
That when she was nine, she had to quit school and take care of her three siblings. And
younger siblings?
Younger siblings.
At nine?
At nine.
In Newark.
And on her watch, one of her siblings drowned. And, you know, the guilt that comes from that. And then she, you know, never went to school. She was planning on going to school and actually having some kind of a career. And she got married, had three children. He died when my mom was nine. And she once again was stuck with three children. And then my mom gets out and we have a Mercedes.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's hateful. And I mean, we paid for everything.
You knew this woman.
I knew this
woman. As an old woman, and she was awful.
She was awful, and she
was... But it's a sad story. Were you able to achieve empathy?
Yes, because her whole life was kind of usurped by tragedy, and she didn't have the education to really...
Yeah.
And I can see how all of a sudden your granddaughter's a movie star and lives in New York City, and your daughter...
Why wouldn't you resent them?
Yeah, and so then you've got one daughter that stays
in
Newark and takes care of her, basically.
Sure.
We're paying... for most of it.
Yeah.
I'm working and paying for most of
it. So you're taking care of her as well?
Mm-hmm. And she just never wanted to give my mom any credit. I would say, oh, Grandma, what about that nice new mattress?
Yeah.
Yes, Louise gave it to me. I was like, no, that's not the daughter who gave it to you. Your other daughter gave it to you. No, I don't think so.
Was she a drinker?
No.
I wonder where your mom got that.
Her father.
Oh, really? You figured that out?
Yeah, I figured that out. And he was funny.
Oh, you remember that guy, too?
I never met him, but the stories about him were just, I mean, she adored him.
Oh, your mom did?
Yeah.
It's so wild to find all this stuff out, right?
Yeah, it is.
Because there's bad, because you spend this time, and there was always this kind of public judgment of your mother. And as it became known that she was a drunk or she had an alcoholism, I shouldn't say, I'm a sober guy. She had alcoholism, but, you know, there was all this judgment, but... You know, when you really kind of build a life around these people and see where they come from, it just opens your heart up a little bit.
It does. And I mean, like one of the craziest moments in the documentary is when you see me sitting in between her and this journalist who's reading a scathing review of my mother.
Right.
And And I feel the need as like a 12-year-old to stick up for her.
Yeah.
And he's like, you know, you've got the ruddy complexion of a drunk.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And then I say, well, you know, with, you know, about her skin, she has allergies. And you're just like, oh.
And they put, but how the fuck are these people that put you in that position?
It was a very weird thing,
you know, and to track, you know, the sexualization of teenagers to you, that's a bold kind of cultural assessment in the doc, but it totally adds up.
Yeah.
Right. That the shift from the Marilyn Monroe kind of Hollywood model of what, you know, sexuality and femininity was completely changes with you to something perverse. That really didn't register culturally until relatively recently.
And you know, it was sort of the Alice, you know, the Alice Little and, you know, and the sort of that, or the Lolita or the whatever. Sure. There was that sort of era. And I was seemingly, I mean, at the center of it.
Yeah. But I mean, but you, like, I don't know that you, it was weird because you didn't strike me as somebody who... The sexuality that was put upon you was something more innocent than like a Lolita character that was more self-willed, it seemed.
Well, and that's what Louis Malle said when he cast me.
Oh, really?
He said he didn't want a Lolita. He didn't want a knowing child who had been in touch with her sexuality or using it as a tool or power.
Yeah.
And he wanted real innocence. And I was like a golden retriever puppy, you know, and I didn't, I mean, it took me probably because of all that, you know, decades to sort of get in touch with my own sexuality because it was so talked about and so, and it was prohibited, then I was in trouble for it, and then my mother was in trouble. It was like, it was such a maelstrom.
But you were aware of all that really cognizantly?
I mean, by the time I had done Blue Lagoon, I'd had enough time in front of the firing squad. And there's one interview that didn't make it to the documentary, and it's this woman interviewing me, and I'm maybe 14, 15, and she keeps asking me the same question over and over and over again. Don't you think you lost your childhood? Or, you know, don't you think you've been robbed? It was that kind of a thing. And I kept saying, no, and I go to a regular school, and it's an enhanced, you know, it's my version of a hobby. I don't play sports. I make movies or whatever that was. I answer the same question three times, maybe more. And finally, I stop and I say, excuse me, you know, I'm with respect. I say, I don't think you want my answer, ma'am.
You did?
And I said, you keep asking me the same question.
What's wrong with you?
And I keep answering it, and you want a different answer, but this is my truth. And so somewhere in my character, God, universe, whatever,
right.
I was able to find the ridiculousness in it.
Well, what's sort of astounding is that you had some kind of inner resilience to it all, that because it doesn't seem at any point during, like, you know, the other path is Drew Barrymore.
I know, yeah.
Yeah, and she's in the doc, and, you know, it's unspoken, but that didn't happen to you. You weren't, you know, taken advantage of. You didn't get strung out or fucked up on drugs, you know, which is the way of children in this business. It usually doesn't end well. But all through this thing, for whatever reason, I don't know if it was your mother or just that people looked out for you and didn't necessarily take advantage of you in that way. But you seem to have some sort of resilience, and you do seem to be, you know, holding on to yourself.
I thank you. And I think that a lot of it has to do with I never moved to Hollywood. Mm. I went to regular schools. I mean,
because your mom?
Yeah. My mom was just like, we're not going out there and giving you the high school equivalency test. She's like, that's just not what we're going to do. She never got to have an education. So it was important.
So spite was important in this.
Spite. She also, my dad was in the beginning paying for my education. Yeah. And then we were able to pay for it ourselves.
Right.
So then that, and, you know, and really just having real people and real friends in my life and being a perfection, wanting to do well in school.
Yeah.
Because it was so far from the entertainment industry.
Right.
And I was a cheerleader. And I was, you know, when you
of course
just,
you were.
If you fight for it enough.
How is Brooke Shields not going to be a cheerleader?
Oh, and I was always the tallest. So I was always at the bottom of the friggin' pyramid, like people sitting on my head.
Oh, yeah.
But there was... convention. It was conventional.
Right.
It was.
And Laura Linney was your pal?
Yeah.
She's in the doc. She's great.
She's great. She's so, it's so funny because she's so, I was like, look at you with your cape dress and all poised and all, you know, you're an actress. So I was like, and so she's been a long time, long term friend that, you know, I've just celebrated. I celebrate her, you know, talent
great actress.
And success.
Yeah. And yeah, Trooper, right?
Oh, yeah.
Really? But so let's talk about those pivotal moments, though. So you're doing the, before anything, really, the first wave of attention that was, you know, problematic was because of that Louis Malle movie, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and as everyone said in that film, in the documentary, like, that could never be made today, not without horrendous scrutiny, not even in Europe. But in retrospect, I mean, not that it matters, but I mean, how do you feel about that movie?
I think it's possibly the only really beautiful film I've ever been in.
Yeah.
I mean, it's extraordinary.
Yeah.
And so much so that I wrote my thesis on it.
You wrote your thesis on your movie?
On my movie and La Comusienne, which is another film of Louis Malle's that has a very similar theme of loss of innocence.
Uh-huh.
That was during the war and a young young man joining the resistance.
Yeah.
And that thematically, it was just such an interesting concept for me, this loss of innocence, you know, and what that voyage looks like, when and how is it shown cinematically, and to just really break down. And at Princeton, you couldn't major in film.
Right.
So I was adamant about sort of, you know, I'm going to make a difference in the system, you know.
Sure.
And I found a way. I was a French lit major, and I found a way then to sort of bring in the film and have looking at it like in a literary way. And
how'd you handle your performance in your thesis?
I didn't really critique my performance other than what he wanted, he got, which was not slick, not learned, you know, it was, I mean, the sad part about it was that I also didn't really learn too much.
Yeah.
And it would have been a really wonderful.
Oh, in terms of as an actress?
Yeah. It would have been a wonderful environment to learn from someone like
him.
But
he just wanted you to be you.
He just wanted me to be me, which, you know, sort of set me on that path. And basically that theme kind of continued for many years.
But there is something to it. You know, you're not, it's not like you're, you know, you're not a shallow person.
Mm.
So whatever you are, always, it seems to be pretty, it comes through all the time, and it's just a variation, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you seem to be kind of the same person, but you've grown up, obviously.
Yeah.
But there's a consistency to it.
Yeah, and I appreciate that too. You know, I mean,
it's amazing.
So I look at that movie, and I'm so proud. I think Endless Love was probably one of the only other beautiful films that I've made. I mean, I think that, you know, Black and White was a movie I was very proud of. Completely improv, and Robert Downey Jr. and again a crazy, crazy cast. But you know, those were European directors.
Yeah,
and they it was art.
They weren't afraid of pushing the envelope a little bit.
No, but they expected the most.
Yeah.
And there's something that I thrived on with that, and was so sort of disappointed everywhere else. You know.
Yeah. Well, I could see that because you were this fundamentally American property somehow.
Yeah. I was America's sweetheart.
Yeah. Right. Kinda. Right.
So they.
Yeah.
I was called that. I was then.
You were.
And then, you know, you're a face of a decade. It's so bizarre.
But it's great that you have that distance. Like, you know, there's not anywhere in the doc or the arc of your personal history that's like, well, that was when Brooke really lost it. And she was rebelling and she did that to her hair. And you didn't have that. Are you sad that you didn't have that? Was there a period that you thought you might?
No, you know, I'm so sort of fundamentally a workhorse and I go to the nth degree. I play by the rules.
Yeah.
I don't really have that. I think I would have been probably, you know, heralded and celebrated had I had some big fuck up, and then I could be the underdog and come back and, you know, do something like
instead
that.
Instead, you just went to college and people forgot about you.
Yeah, exactly. Instead, I got an education.
Yeah.
That'll serve me.
Yeah. but do you, I think, do you, how much do you, you know, credit deep codependency to your drive?
Oh, it's absolutely like, enmeshment, codependency. Yeah.
We felt like you had it. Like, you know, it's just what you did. It was you were your mother's appendage.
And then the world.
Right.
And then you've got what I owe my fans and what I owe the press.
When did you start feeling that?
Oh, that was just always put on me. It was my mom was like, now listen,
yeah,
you know, every single autograph you sign, it's one person and that's, yeah, and they are individual and you have to. So, you know, I
was. Oh, she really asked you to show up for these people.
Oh, yeah. And
it's exhausting.
It's exhausting and it's constant and it's never enough. And you don't, and it's not really directly proportionate.
And you're a kid. So, like, you know, if that's starting when you're 12.
Oh, yeah.
So how do you, how is she handling your downtime so you don't, you know, burn out?
I think we had a lot of fun.
Oh, you did?
I mean, I also took it upon myself to say, you know, I was their bubble.
Yeah.
Like, I was the bubble on the set. I was the funny one. I danced and sang, did songs and stuff.
Yeah.
But we went to see movies. We went to see theater. We, you know, we traveled. We
you did New
laughed.
York.
We did New York. We lived in the city. I mean, I was born and raised.
Yeah. How were you going to Studio 54? How old were you?
15,
and not 16. And not seeing all kinds of insanity.
You saw it, but somehow I was like a mascot. It was like I was the boss's daughter or something. Know, saw the bag, but bag never got to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it was almost as if
people
like,
looking out for you again.
They were all looking out for me, and Steve Rubell like put the word out like she is not to be fucked with.
Yeah.
And it's not even she wants to come. She dances for like an hour and a half. I'd pick the best dancer.
Sure.
And you know, I was home by 11:30. You know, and then I'd bring my girlfriends.
You are so lucky you didn't get alcoholism.
I'm probably on my way now.
but I mean, like if you like, you know, somehow or another, I'm still trying to figure out how you had this kind of a personal integrity that didn't make you need, you know, your neediness was not, you know, driving you.
I also was really afraid of lack of control. And so
that's what happens when you have an alcoholic mother.
Yeah.
So, either you're going to be an alcoholic or you're going to be a complete control freak.
Absolutely. And so that I chose that because I had to keep her alive.
Right.
So I was hyper vigilant all the time.
That's it. Well, that's what it is.
Peripheral all the
time.
That's
the answer.
And so I would, you know, I call it a broadcast news moment. But when Holly Hunter pulls out the plug of the phone and she quickly cries like crazy, and then she plugs the phone back in and she picks it up. And that's what I would do. I would do that. I would like go into the
that
hotel bathroom and like sit under the sink and cry really fast and then be like, okay, that's done.
That's wild because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. That answers the question. I'm sitting here like, how are you so resilient? How did you have your shit together? You're just sort of like, I'm managing everything all the time. I'm on top of it.
Yeah. I mean, because without that, all hell was going to break loose. What was going to happen? And, you know, you take that on as a kid and you just take it on. And that's
you don't even know it. It's how you're wired.
Yeah. And then it made me, you know, I was an overachiever. You know, I had to get straight A's. It wasn't from my mom or my dad. Yeah. You know, they'd be like, give yourself a little bit of a break. I'd be like, no.
Yeah.
I have to get an A. That was my addiction.
Right.
You know, that was my form of addiction.
Well, the codependency, perfectionism thing, mm-hmm. It's rough, man. You know, because you do eventually hit a bottom.
Yeah. And it's exhausting.
Yeah, but like eventually you're just depleted. But like, let me ask you a question before we get to that. Like, you know, because I'd forgotten the Calvin Klein ads. I knew you were. I remember that billboard in New York because I used to go visit my grandmother in Jersey when I was in high school. I'd come from New Mexico, and it was somewhere around. There was still one of the smoking billboards around.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that blue smoke rings? Mm-hmm. Yours was somewhere up around there, and then the one with the smoke rings was there in Times Square. Like, I remember that, but I don't really remember registering, you know, those ads where you're posing and stuff. Now, obviously, you know, there's a segment of him, of Calvin talking about it, of him knowing that he was sexualizing you and being cute about it. Now, do you have any resentment around that stuff? Or do you feel...
Oh, God, no. I mean, it was the first time I was ever able to actually combine acting and modeling.
Right.
And it was so stressful. The dialogue and
it was really well done. I mean, you were, you know, you really nailed it.
I mean, I worked so hard on that.
Did you have a coach?
No, but Avedon was directing, and he was such a perfectionist as well.
He's a genius. Did you work with him a lot?
I did a lot. All my Vogue covers.
Yeah. so you had a relationship with him?
Yes, yes. And he liked me because I was well-behaved. I did the job.
Yeah.
We had a very good communication. I knew exactly what he meant when he did whatever, he cocked his head a certain way.
Sure.
And so it was just a very, he was an artist as well. You
sure,
know?
The American West book is one of my favorite books.
And I was fascinated with the darkness and light. Like, it was always so interesting to me. It was incubated. Nobody else was allowed in. There weren't stylists, hairdressers, nobody. It was just us. And it was hard work.
For
photo shoots.
Any of them.
The Calvin Klein took days and days.
But those were live action, right?
Yeah. There. And those were memorized. You know, that minute long commercial was memorized.
Yeah.
And
it was just you and Richard.
Yeah.
Huh.
And, you know, a great team of people that were writing
it.
I think, I even think, because it could it be Delia Ephron that helped write the copy?
Yeah.
And so the copy was beautiful.
Yeah.
The hidden meaning in all of it was so smart to me. You know,
yeah.
I was a junior, I guess, in high school, or maybe a little bit younger. But, you know, that type of using your brain at the same time was sort of, it was a revelation to me.
Right. So you weren't really thinking about how you were being used necessarily.
No.
You were just doing the script and doing the pose and physicalizing.
You're selling.
So you knew that.
You're selling. Absolutely. Okay, did I clock that the camera was panning up my thigh? It was for jeans. Okay, you're...
No, you know, I get it, but you knew you were selling.
Yeah, you knew you were...
You always know that as a model?
I mean, I was holding up, you know, Love's Baby Soft. And
at the beginning.
You know, color-corrected bottles.
But when you're just doing general, like, you know, covers or when you're not holding things up... there's an art to it, isn't there? That's something beyond selling. It's a natural thing. I get it.
Covers are very different. Covers are very sort of an intimate way of, you know, the insides are you're selling clothes and you have to sort of make it a certain way.
Yeah.
But the cover was always, you know, you're looking down the barrel of something and really it's just you and the photographer.
Right.
And it's very intimate. And very, it's otherworldly.
But do you think is it not your nature to sort of be critical of how you were being used?
I mean, now I can look at it, can look back at it and say, but I'm not being a Pollyanna about it, but I am saying that's what the business is. You don't get to have it both ways.
Right.
You know, you don't.
No. And it wasn't like, and you have a very successful career. Why are you going to be like, you know, fuck that campaign?
It changed
the world. It was like an atomic bomb.
We also got to move into a house and we bought a car. And so it was always so directly proportionate to making life better.
Did you maintain a relationship with Calvin Klein?
Oh, yeah. I had to do a few episodes of a series before my podcast, but a series. And he came on and he was so cute because it was about 25 minutes or something. And after that, I said, oh, you know, thank you. And he's like, that's it? And I said, yeah. He goes, I planned on being here like an hour. And I said, and, you know, it was nice for me to hear later how he did attribute that to changing his entire career.
Well, of course,
You know, and what happened was I didn't get renewed for the second year.
Yeah.
And my feelings were really hurt. I thought I'd failed and because it was a 2-year contract.
Right.
And they didn't do the second year. And evidently it was, from what I was told, about the fact that I became so identified with. So people were going in and saying, can we get the Brooke Shields jeans?
Yeah.
And that was not the point.
Yeah.
You know, he needed them. It needed to be Calvin Klein jeans, which is obvious. You know?
Right. And then, I can't remember what the evolution of the Calvin Klein ads were, but they continued to be provocative.
Yeah.
But they used Marky Mark for a while.
Oh, yeah.
And then there was the wood paneling, weird kind of rec room period.
Right. And Kate Moss,
yeah,
you know, was in a lot of those. I mean, he was always provocative.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's like, and he wasn't pretending to not be. You know, yeah. That's always what's so interesting is you know, to do a movie about the red light district in New Orleans in the early 1900s. You know what you're doing the movie about.
Well, I think what the issue is now is we're looking at it through a contemporary lens,
right.
It's sort of, you know, kind of redefining cultural perception, mm-hmm. right? Like, you know, it was all different then. It was all, there was a lot more permissiveness. There was less mm-hmm. regulation around, you know, moral attitudes. And there was more art in general.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there was, and everything's very cut and dry now. And everything.
And this was New York, you know,
of course, and it was great. Like, I mean, it was great, you know, but looking through the contemporary lens, I imagine, you know, that have you had run-ins with feminist ideologues around how they perceived you?
You know, not as much so, more like Christian
yeah, right.
groups.
Sure.
Like that was it, because there was something about my reaction to all of it that feminists have actually been positive about. This sort
you
of
owned it.
Owning it and, yeah. and not becoming a victim.
Right, right.
And understanding and owning who you were and being and not sort of just saying, look, you're the one that has the problem.
But
with
you
this.
Weren't a victim. You know, it's yeah, you weren't a victim because your mother was sort of, although she you know, kind of put you into this, she always took care of you to a degree.
I always felt loved. I always felt
you
protected.
You didn't turn into a mess?
No.
You know, it wasn't a tragic story.
No, and I think that that's what I'm not ever going to be a tragic story. It's just, it's not an option. I don't not, it, and it doesn't matter what shit happens or what, you know, you go through. It's really, you know, how do you go through your life? How are you going to choose to go through it?
Well, yeah, and you're fortunate to have this horrendous perfectionism streak and constant need to control everything.
And you know, that's been, like, letting go of that over time, not fully, well, obviously.
Well, it's funny that the one point, you go, because I got sensitive to it, you know, outside of, you know, a very bad thing that happened to you, but the real dip where you start to feel like, oh, I feel bad for Brooke is when you're kind of out of college and you got to do like local commercials.
Oh, it's just torture. And I was like 20 pounds heavier. I had like,
you're doing the dancing and everything.
Bad hair. And I didn't know, I thought it was over. I didn't know what to do.
So you were taking any job?
We had a townhouse in New York City and a big house in New Jersey.
So what were those conversations with your mother like?
You know what? We were just like, all right, there's this Nescafe commercial being shot in Italy, but it's going to be dubbed into Japanese and they want you. So, we, you know, and she would, I didn't have an agent. So, you know, she would just, it could be somebody that she met on the plane.
Yeah.
Some Japanese businessman she met on the plane. And before you know it, I'm doing, you know, whatever that thing was where I was on the pedestal. It was so, like, there was no quality in anything, but
right.
we needed the money.
But, and, okay, so you don't, but again, you saw that as a necessity and you don't resent the situation because you were in a partnership and but you knew that we need money.
We need money. And also, yeah. I had this degree, so I could intellectualize from college. You know, I'd graduated
with
from college.
Degree? What's the degree?
French lit.
Oh yeah,
and that, you know, that was going to be my. I was going to carry that like my armor, and I started, you know, intellectualizing everything and going to therapy more and studying acting. And I thought, you know, this is what it's going to take. You know, this is what they call being an artist. And I just threw myself into that because I didn't know what else to do.
It was just the time where you had the horrible rape?
Yes. Yep. I
was going to say something else, but I realized we can just say rape.
It. Yeah. Sorry. It, you know, it's taken me decades to even call it that.
Because you talked to, like, Gavin DeBecker, who was your security guy since you were a kid, huh?
Yeah.
You must have started him in the business.
I was, he was before he had his full company, and I was 13. And he, you know, he had sort of taken care of Elizabeth Taylor as a kid and Rosemary Clooney, and, you know, and he had had a lot of tragedy in his life, and he's just brilliant as a
yeah,
person.
Yeah, I've reached out to him for advice before.
Oh, he's just...
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't know how funny he is, but man, is he funny. And I was 13. And
yeah.
So he was the first call, like kind of the only call
So in the doc, to clear it up for people, you talk about this, but it took you a long time to acknowledge it as that, and you compartmentalized it somehow?
Completely.
And you chose not to mention the person's name, which is, you know, unique in this particular climate. But you did finally acknowledge that you were raped.
I acknowledged that. It was an unwanted situation,
right.
And it took me a long time to acknowledge it as assault and rape and whatever word you want to call it, because it wasn't consensual, you know. Then my reaction was to just shut down.
Yeah,
and I think that, you know, I was so scarred by it that I couldn't afford to acknowledge it at all. My career was in such a bad place. I was currently doing
this. Was a producer who you said he might have a movie.
Yeah. And you know, I thought I was getting a job.
You knew the guy.
Yeah. I've known the guy forever. And I thought, oh, I'm this is how it's gonna happen. It's gonna be my turn. It's gonna You know, and now they know I'm an actress and they're gonna, you know.
Oh my God.
And then to go back to this, like, really shitty movie that I was doing where I can't even remember the name of it, but it was one of those movies that never sees the light of day. It probably just goes to VHS at that point. And, you know, the lead guy did all his lines in Italian and I did all my lines in English. Uh-huh. And I'm just, that happened and I'm going back to this set and I just feel like such a joke. I feel like I'm just a loser. And I'm just, that there is, it's not, and... Don't, you know, I'm done. I was over.
Yeah.
And it really broke me. But then I thought, okay, well, then I'm going to get better.
But what did you do to treat it? Did you think you were in PTSD looking back on it? Or did you just, you know, you compartmentalized it?
I talked about it and through therapy, just ad nauseum, and had to go through the sort of stages. You know, it's almost like the stages of grief, you know, and I had to I put a lot of blame on myself. I justified everything. It must have been my fault.
And DeBecker was the one who told you that it was assault?
Yeah, he wanted me immediately to just blow it out of the water and make a huge, like, international case. And I was like, Gav, I can't get much lower than this, but I can tell you that I will never work again because nobody's going to believe me. And I couldn't afford it. I could not afford it emotionally. So I just chose to do the work with a therapist and really just learn how your body processes information, you know?
And was part of your therapy to confront the perp?
I had done that on my own.
Oh.
I had written a long letter heard anything. Never heard anything back. And
why the choice even now in the climate we live in not to call the guy out?
Because you know what? It would be then about him.
Right.
And this is my this is my experience to own on my own.
Okay.
And the way the press works and the way people work, it doesn't matter.
Sure.
You know what I mean? It really doesn't matter who it is, but that
they just want
it would matter.
Grist. Yeah.
Yeah. It would be a headline. And
of course.
I'm not giving that.
Yeah. Why be? Because then you'd just be part of this story that you've unleashed. And,
you know, and I've done, again, so much work, and I'm interviewing Dr. Badera, who talks about this, that writing a letter is a very common thing that happens, and that there are ways of compartmentalizing, ways of shutting down. You go into it's not even fight or flight. She calls it something else. I can't remember right now, but it's this, it's what the brain does and how the brain reacts to a situation that is a place you don't want to be in.
Yeah.
And how you have to survive.
It's like a paralysis almost. If something shuts down.
Absolutely. Yeah. You just think, okay, just stay alive.
Right.
And get out.
Yeah.
You know, and so it was
it's literally like playing dead under a dead body.
Yeah. It's a good metaphor. Very good metaphor.
Yeah.
You know, and if you, there's no point in, you know, I didn't know if I was going to mention it in the doc. And then I thought, I can't be this honest about absolutely everything.
Yeah.
Be the mother of two daughters.
Right.
And not at least say, listen, this, you know, this shit happens and it can't anymore.
How did they take it?
My older daughter knew. She like beat it out of me one night.
Yeah.
She got wind. She figured something out.
Yeah.
We were with a lot of people and she just kind of clocked something and she just hammered me. And I said, okay, I'm going to sit you down. I'm going to tell you.
How old was she?
This was just a couple of years ago.
Uh-huh.
And my younger one was clueless and until the documentary. And I didn't warn her. And I don't know why I didn't think to warn her.
Yeah.
What happened? She got up in the middle of the screening and ran out of the screening room crying. And I just, my husband was very upset. And I thought, how we live, who we are now, is so healthy and happy.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, we're a good family. Like, they're great girls. They're grown up. They're,
sure.
You know, we have a very honest, you know, life. But I had put it behind me, and I guess, and she just said, Mom, nothing you say is going to make me feel better about this. So it's just going to take time. I don't want to see anybody hurt my mom.
Right.
And I said, I love you. I appreciate that. I'm so sorry that I didn't warn you and I didn't prepare you.
Yeah.
This will be, end up being, hopefully, good for the world.
And, sure.
You know, as being an advocate for people that are, maybe don't feel like they have the voice. I refuse to become the poster child for it.
Sure.
And she... You know, she got it. She's going to come to the premiere, probably just because she wants to be on the red carpet. 16.
Yeah.
She will be 17 very soon.
Well, I imagine growing up in the world that they're growing up in and you know, having a definition at that age of predator, toxic masculinity, mm-hmm. you know, abuse, you know, that they know all that stuff. And it's terrifying, I would imagine. And then to hear your mom just, that it happened to you.
Yeah.
I mean, it would be like, even picture yourself with your crazy mother
mm-hmm.
protecting her
all
the time. Like, you know, the idea of helplessness and you know.
And but it, we were, it, you know, I was from the time with my, you know, my mom lost a baby. And when I lost my first child, I kind of knew it, but I didn't know she could not come clean and tell me. And I thought, wow, that's interesting. You know, I hope I'm able to be honest with my children in the future when they need it.
Well, it's tricky because you have to protect them as well.
So, I know.
I mean, it's like, it's a negotiation, I guess you would have to make. I don't have kids, but I imagine it, you have to weigh it out.
Yeah. And also I tried to make it a teaching moment, you know,
sure.
Yes, this is the way your mom, you know, but you've got to know that these things exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the victim shaming is such a big piece of it, you know,
right.
And it's a huge, huge part of it. And, you know, that old,
the fear of telling your story because it'll be disregarded or framed.
And, you know, why did you put yourself in that position
kind of a question line
of questioning. And that was a good way for me. You know, and the interesting, these kids are, they're, you know, on the one hand, they're so woke. And then on the other, you know, that they don't want to talk. They don't want to talk about these things. And they don't want, yet they're also, we had a huge discussion about all of this, you know, about owning your own person and what they do on TikTok and how they almost sexualize themselves.
Well, yeah, and also there's apparently a kind of frequency in the culture that is sort of almost anti-vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, like this idea of cringe
is
really around vulnerability, which is a good thing.
Yeah. I mean,
so they're learning how to, you know, like to almost become deadened and almost grow up as brands.
Mm-hmm. And they think that they're owning, but it's a different type of ownership.
Yeah, it's a weird thing.
Yeah, it's very odd, and I can't quite figure out what's happening to the pendulum.
But also because you were like before this age of social media platform. I mean, you were a brand.
Mm-hmm.
you know, but, you know, somehow or another, you were kind of casually unaware of the impact, I think, at times.
I also, it was too much to really
process.
Mm. I mean, you know, it's, I would do my homework when I was in the hair and makeup chair, and I would, you know, and they'd say, well, what do you like? Do you like it? And I'd just go, uh-huh, yeah, it's great. Like,
sure.
Looking at myself in the mirror was always very hard for me because
it's been weird.
It was just weird. Yeah. And you can't see yourself the way other people see you. Yeah. So you're just disappointed.
Yeah.
And that's weird.
Yeah.
And, you know, like in dance class, I couldn't spot because I didn't want to look at myself in the mirror. And he would say,
wow.
The teacher was like, get over yourself. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
Look, spot, or you're going to fall on your ass all the time.
Well, you couldn't look at yourself even when you didn't have makeup on?
Anyway, it was just don't gaze. Don't gaze at yourself. Don't look in the reflection.
Why?
Oh, there was something vanity. It was vanity.
Really?
I mean, that's what I interpreted as.
So you were trying to work against how you were being used in a way.
And how I was being like fawned over.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you're so beautiful. And you think, I didn't do anything to look like this. Like, I can't.
Right.
Can I just get value from I went to a good school or I gave a good performance, or it was just, it was never that.
But eventually it became that. I mean, you know, you became this like hilarious actress.
Thank you.
I think it's funny because you are very funny, and you know that's one of the great defense mechanisms.
Is the
humor
best?
And like you know, it's sort of exciting that people exploited that in you later, that you did it yourself.
I mean, I couldn't believe my luck, but I'd been fighting for it forever, you know, and just it was my absolute happy place, It just so by the time I got Suddenly Susan, I was just soaring with joy.
There you go, and that's and that was after your bottom was really these like Japanese commercials,
where I'm dressed as the Statue of Liberty and I'm on a big tall platform, but I also. I did Grease, I went on Broadway.
Huge. I remember that. Yeah.
And that was
a big deal. Everyone was like, can she do it? It was because is this just a placement of a name?
But it was that. I mean, it was the first time stunt casting really ever happened.
Yeah.
And had it not existed, the likes of me would never have been on.
Yeah.
I wasn't considered Broadway,
Right, sure. But you did great.
I did. And I went on to do kind of amazing work on Broadway and just got so confident about it.
You know?
It just felt really good because it was associated with really hard work.
Yeah.
So I was triggered in a good way.
Yeah. Well, obviously we can't talk about everything, but most of it's in the doc. The Agassi thing is it just one of those things? Like I was somebody's, mistake. Like I was married to somebody and I really think at this point it was only for a few years and I really think she just sees it as like bad phase.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, listen, my first husband, it's like people say you marry your father or whatever that thing is. I married a very controlling person. I married an industry. I married a conglomerate, and I could disappear in it.
Right.
And I loved it.
And you needed that
and I
at
needed
the time.
It.
Yeah.
And I needed to be able to separate from my mom. And I needed a cushion in, he took care of everything.
Yeah.
I mean, I had, by that point, we had about 6 houses. My mom, every time my mom traveled, and we did a photo shoot or something, she would buy a ranch or, buy a lake house. And we just... We had all this property and no cash flow.
Yeah.
And so, he systematically helped me sell the properties, do the next and next and next,
right.
And helped me separate from my mom with care and love. I mean, minus when I gutted her office, which was a less than, gracious thing that I did do. But he...
Oh, and you emptied the office. And
And that was pretty brutal, I will say.
Yeah. But necessary?
The only way I would have known how to do it. It was like ripping a Band-Aid off.
Sure.
And it was not... She was never going to make it easy for me to separate.
Yeah.
I mean, I tried mediators and I tried, and she just... She was so hurt.
And you tried intervening with the alcoholism when you were 13 and again and again and again?
And again and again. I mean, she was in multiple rehabs, but, so you just... all of a sudden I was safe.
Right.
And I was childlike.
Yes.
And we were like little children together, and we both had very strong parents. We both had reached, you know, huge fame at a young age. We identified with each other.
Well, that's interesting. So that's like the same with Michael Jackson too, in a way,
mm-hmm.
that you were all sort of suspended emotionally.
Yeah, it was arrested development for
very
sure.
Young. Yeah, and that stayed there.
And a great deal of responsibility.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that was, you know, we saw something in the other person. Andre and I laughed a lot too, yeah. which was really, which
are
was
you, do you,
great.
Are you in touch still?
No. Mm-mm. No, I thought we would be because it was not ugly.
Yeah.
It took 7 minutes. I mean, it was
sure.
just, but I, that's not the kind of person he is.
Right.
Like when you're out.
Right. Yeah.
And he wrote a book, ironically called Open, in which he asked me to read all the parts I was in. And I thought that was very generous.
Sure.
So I spent 5 hours with his ghostwriter, and I made sure he knew that I penned my own books. Just threw that in there. just had an editor, not a ghostwriter. And I said, I changed all this. He said, you know, I don't remember dates, but you have diaries and you have all this stuff. So
sure.
please help fix the things I don't remember. And I said, okay. And there were many. Everything was just off.
Right.
And then I got a letter. typed letter about a month later saying, thank you so much for your time. Unfortunately, I couldn't change any of the things that you corrected because that's not how I remember it. And it is my book.
Wow.
And I was like, what? And then I told my publisher, my editor, and I said, and she said, oh, it's the like oldest trick in the book. Because when you go to press, you can say, oh, yes, I gave it to her to read.
Oh, right.
And that indicates that I signed off on it, which of course I didn't.
You got duped.
I got duped in a big way.
Oh my God.
So, but.
There you go. That's enough not to talk to somebody for a while.
Yeah. We don't, you know what? There's so little that we have in common.
Right. And also like, look, it's old news. And it's like, if you've worked through whatever resentments or are you, what are you going to, you know, what you need it for? You don't have kids with the guy.
No, don't. And also it's like, it was exactly what I needed at that time.
Sure. It seemed like it.
Yeah. It was really perfect. I was saved.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So now, you know, I didn't know anything about the postpartum depression stuff.
Oh, no.
No. I mean, I don't know why I would. It's not really my world of reading.
No, I know.
You know, but, you know, like it did strike something in me around, you know, my mother, you know, who...
Yeah.
Yeah, because she said to me, you know, in a very glib way a few years ago, she just out of nowhere said, you know, Mark, when you were a baby, I don't think I knew how to love you. And I'm like,
ooh,
wow.
Hey,
thank you for that piece.
Yeah.
That answers a lot of questions.
Doctor.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But I don't know if she was depressed or just selfish. I don't know. But I mean, but it's definitely a symptom of that.
But is it? It is a symptom. And it can be, there's such a range, you know, it's sort of like postpartum to psychosis. You know, there's this huge range of levels of it. And
it's so heartbreaking, that whole part of the doc and that part of your story, because you were just so, like, you couldn't understand your mind.
I couldn't understand my mind. And it's such a brilliant, any type of mental affliction or illness or irregularity or unbalance, I should say, you know, biochemically, you don't, it's speaking perfectly to you.
Right. But for a person who's got their shit together so aggressively.
Mm, right.
You know, and to not understand something that you're generating, it's got to be the worst.
It's the worst. It's taking everything that made me who I am and absolutely ripping my legs out from under me and having no tools, no knowledge, and letting people down because they can't fix it.
And so this is your first kid?
My first kid.
And, you know, how long did it take you to learn about it and get treatment? How old was she? Do you feel like she suffered at all because of this period?
I convinced myself that she was suffering because her father kind of came in and, you know,
well,
did all
like
the...
He seems like a sweet guy.
Yeah, he is. He's a great guy. He's funny, too. Mm. So, he just kind of went into mode, and he had never sort of held a baby before, and now he was doing it. And they have a very strong relationship, yeah. And I sort of beat myself up about that for a long time. You know, I thought, you made them bond, and you did this to yourself. And yeah. It was like, it just was amazing. But it only really lasted, it took some months. It was about 6 months. By a year, I had found the right medication and, uh-huh. and sort of combination of things. And so, and I went through the motions
of
bonding with her. Do you know what I mean? I was just so unhappy. I was so desperate.
You couldn't understand why your heart wasn't following suit?
Yes. Right. And why she was such a stranger to me. You know, you look at this, it comes out of your body.
Yeah.
And you don't recognize it.
Yeah.
It doesn't, I was exhausted. I had gone through IVF 7 times. I lost so much blood when I gave birth to her and herniated my uterus. I mean, it was just everything that could have gone wrong.
Yeah.
I thought I was going to die. They were going to give me a hysterectomy.
Yeah.
And so there was so much trauma that I experienced. And then I get home. And I don't know what to do with a baby.
Yeah.
And I'm depleted, and I'm completely biochemically imbalanced, and no one knows it. They just say, stop breastfeeding or stop doing this. Yeah. And it's just, you just feel so helpless and scared.
Was there no literature on postpartum at that time?
Nothing. Nobody told us anything. I told the doctor, and he was like, oh, it's the baby blues. And
that's what they called it. That's the best they had?
Mm-hmm. You'll get over it. It's just, you're tired, and once you get some sleep. And
so it was really not a pathology at the time.
It was, but no one talked about it, and we weren't in.
Was there a name for it?
It was postpartum depression.
But was that name there then?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
So what had happened was a doctor called me back, and his wife was a doula, and he said, I apologize for violating the patient-doctor privilege or whatever, but you really worried me. And I talked to my wife about it, and she's a doula, and she thinks that you are experiencing postpartum depression, and would you take medication? Of course, I said, no, I'm not going to take medication. I've never had to take medication to be fixed before.
Mm.
I fix myself, and I do it myself.
Yeah.
And it was just so bleak that— And everybody said, please, 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 please.
Oh, the pictures of you are horrendous.
I mean, you can just
look like, haunted.
Haunted. My mother-in-law called me. She said, I saw dead eyes.
Yeah.
And I just, So I finally said, okay, to get everybody off my back, I'll take a pill.
Yeah.
Clearly, I'm just, I'm going to be an actress that takes pills now, you know?
Yeah. So, oh, really? Yeah. Yeah, you had a whole life set out for yourself.
Yes.
Really pictured the worst of it.
Oh, yeah. Of course I did. I live in the wreckage of the future.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, so you took them?
So I took them, started feeling better, just started feeling normal, and started, wanting to be around her, and the smell of the powder of the diapers didn't make my legs weak anymore. It was that there's something so visceral about what happens biochemically. And I started just feeling just more myself.
Yeah.
So I went off cold turkey because clearly I was a doctor by that point.
Sure.
And
anyone who takes medicine is a doctor.
Ostensibly, I was a doctor. And so I had a very bad episode. Where I thought I was going to drive my car into the wall on, the 405. And you see it. I mean, that it has pictures and they rush. And if you close your eyes, the pictures rush into your brain. And it's terrifying.
Wow.
And I was one with the phones, had the big thing that was in the car. And I called my doctor, and she said, what are you doing right now? And I said, I'm on the freeway. And she said, okay, what happened? Did you go off the medication? And I said, yes, cold turkey. And she said, how's that working out for you? And I said, this is not good. And she said, stay on the phone with me. You're going to drive home, and you're going back on immediately. She said, medicine is there for a reason. It does not mean you are weak or you are a failure or anything.
Did you stop taking it in light of the Tom Cruise bullshit?
No. God, no. I stopped taking this before the Tom Cruise thing. Because I hadn't talked about it.
Nobody talked about it
until I wrote the book. So that was about a year later.
So this is all part of the book,
yeah.
The journey of it.
Yep.
And then you, did you find, was there support groups or anything? I mean, when you wrote the book, were you talking to other people?
I first talked to people and everybody denied it. And everyone.
Because of shame?
Yeah.
Wow.
And then people would come to me secretly and they would say, you know, I think my sister's struggling.
Oh my God.
My wife is, you know, but it's supposed to be the most natural thing in the world. I mean, babies have been being born for quite some time.
Yeah. And, but the funny thing is like, you know, more than about half of them don't turn out great.
I know.
There's so much.
I don't like people just in general.
Sure.
I don't like people, but kids, and I don't like other people's kids.
Right. Yeah.
It was unfathomable. I was so thrown and nobody knew. And I broke my husband. I mean, he felt so helpless. And then people started quietly saying, you know, I think I had it.
Yeah.
I think my mom had it. Or
isn't it weird about it's like this has been this thing in my brain lately. It's like people who don't take responsibility for their mental problems are just spawning generations of that mental problem.
Mm-hmm.
It never stops.
No.
You know?
You can't power through it and buck up.
But it's like hereditary. It's just almost.
Yeah.
Just behaviorally hereditary. Maybe not postpartum, but in general, you know, if you have a problem, whether it's alcoholism or borderline or whatever,
you're predisposed.
Sure. You know, right. And you don't take responsibility for it. You're just gifting it to the next generation,
right.
or at least the reaction to it, whatever that is.
And that's why I think I decided to write the book was because it was so ludicrous to me.
Yeah.
That this was something that people were ashamed of. I said, like, I didn't choose to have this.
Yeah.
And when it helped understanding it biophysically, you know, because then it was not my fault.
Sure. But the Tom Cruise thing, that was Scientology bullshit. And you pushed back.
I did.
And you can see that in the movie. And I guess, like, to wrap it up, though, now that you have these daughters and given what you went through, I mean, what are your primary concerns and what are the sort of nuggets of advice you give them in relation to how you came up in the world?
Oh, gosh. I mean, we talk a lot about everything. You know, they think it was the olden days. You know?
Sure.
They were like, you're old, Mom. And they don't, they'll say, Mom, you don't get it because it wasn't like that for you.
Yeah.
And so I say, all right, then you tell me how it is and let's have a conversation about it. What I try to instill in them is work ethic, manners, meaning respect.
Sure.
Owning your space, listening, being a good friend as well, you know, being that there are, I mean, my children are very moral. I have to say one of them is very righteous and my older one is, she's a bit more easygoing about things. They're very much their own people.
Yeah.
And I think that I've tried to teach them to be their own person because I didn't know who my own person was.
Yeah.
And I found—
You belong to the world, Brooke Shields.
I did. I did, but you know, also, it's so interesting because when this doc was presented to me, my actress ego immediately sort of went to, oh, everybody's going to see my work.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then I had to sort of step back from that and really realize that this was a bigger story. And I wanted my girls to see how to survive and keep going through life.
Yeah.
And don't let yourself be beaten. You're going to be hurt. You'll be scared. But surround yourself with good people.
Yeah. Get a Laura Linney.
Yeah. Yep. And get, you know, and pick your friends.
Yeah.
And find something that makes you happy.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And really do it. I mean, really find the joy in it because it's going to be hard. You're going to be rejected and no matter what you choose.
Yeah.
But the joy that I get from being who I am as an actress is worth all of it.
Well,
to
that's
me,
good. Yeah. And did they hear all that? Did they take
it? They hear it. They take it. And they fight me on certain things. But when I start talking to them about this stuff, they see the experience, yeah. And they. My older daughter said, "You're the strongest person I've ever known, Mom." And she said, you know, I watched the documentary. She watched it by herself. And she said, "I can't believe there's so much I didn't know. But you're really cooler than I thought."
There you go. See, there it is. Got a few points.
Yeah, I'll take it.
Good talking to you.
Thank you.
How can you not love Brooke Shields? Huh? Pretty Baby, Brooke Shields, is now streaming on Hulu. That was fun. Hang out for a second, people. Hey, folks. This episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on. Okay, I've been talking for a couple months now about the movies of Kelly Reichardt, and I finally got to talk to her after seeing her newest film, Showing Up. Here's what happens. So I see a coming attraction for the new one, for a trailer for Showing Up. And there was a moment in it that I thought was so acute and perceptive that I just, like, it. I had to watch every one of your movies because of one moment in the trailer. Now, I had seen... You know, Wendy and Lucy, when it came out, I think. And I had seen First Cow, but I never put them together as, you know, I never connected the tissue of you and your work. So that one moment where that guy's digging that hole in Showing Up and he says, it's a big work, an important work. What does he say?
He says, it's a piece, a very important piece.
That was it.
Yeah.
A very important piece. And then once I realized it was about artists, and I dated a painter for years. And there was something about that moment that sort of revealed the kind of delusion that an artist has to have in order to believe that their work is relevant.
Right. All of us.
That's right.
Yeah.
But I thought it was so hilarious in that moment without any context.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, right.
So then I'm like, oh, my God, who is this person who made this movie? You'll hear that full conversation on Thursday. And a reminder, if you want access to every episode of WTF ad-free and get weekly bonus content, sign up for WTF Plus. There's a link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. Here we go. Simple power chords. Here we go. Dirty. Boomer lives. Monkey, LaFonda, cat angels everywhere. Thank you.